Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Welcome to episode 6 of Say Why to Drugs, with me, Dr. Susie Gage, a researcher at the University of Bristol. In these podcasts, I'm chatting to rapper and podcaster Scroobius Pip, and each episode we discuss a different recreational drug. This episode, we're focusing on psychedelics. And these are a group of drugs which alter perception while a person's intoxicated on them. Some of these substances occur naturally, such as psilocybin in magic mushrooms or mescaline in the peyote cactus. Some have been synthesised, such as LSD, lysergic acid diethylamide, whose psychedelic effect was first seen by Albert Hofmann in 1943 when he accidentally got some on his fingers. Later on in the podcast, Pip and I talk about this, and I couldn't remember the date that this happened, but it was 1943, so I've added it here. So anyway, without further ado, here is episode 6 of Say Why to Drugs, which is about psychedelics. Great. So in this episode, I thought that we would talk about psychedelics.
Yes. And that's the drug that I've, we've touched upon in the past, and we should clarify that now, as this is kind of the second half of ones that we're recording. The only reason I'm here is I've done drugs in the past. I don't do any now, so I've not got any bias in that way. Similar with the Stop and Search podcast on the network that's about the legalisation of drugs. I'm very much supportive of that, but I've got no personal interest in it. So it's that kind of, I'm happy to be unbiased and talk of my experiences and, again, be educated by your information.
Excellent, yeah. So this is an episode where I've had a bit of discussion with friends and people on the internet about whether I should do one episode for psychedelics or kind of split them up. But at the moment, I've put them all together.
Yeah.
But maybe in future episodes, we could focus on specific psychedelics as a sort of individual thing rather than the category as a whole.
Because it is a weird one that crosses over in that it's got natural and pharmaceutical,
and
I guess, or synthetic. Sorry, I don't know the term. But it's got natural and synthetic legs of it, so you will have people who take mushrooms, or you'll have people who take acid, and all sorts of different things in between.
Yeah, so I think in particular I've sort of focused on LSD, acid, magic mushrooms, where the active ingredient is psilocybin, mescaline, and DMT, so the active ingredient being ayahuasca.
Yeah, because ayahuasca is one we touched upon on one of the previous episodes, and I couldn't remember the name of it. Remember when I was saying that people go off to Peru for a spiritual thing? It was ayahuasca, and I listened back to that episode, and I was shouting at myself, it's ayahuasca, you idiot. But yes, that's fascinating.
Well, so would you like to tell me what you think the appeal of psychedelics is?
I mean, for me, when I started, and again, I'll be honest, of all the drugs I've done, my favourite have been hallucinogenics. And for me, it's a really interesting one, because as a youngster, when you start off, it's because of the culture around it, reading Timothy Leary and listening to The Doors and things like this. Yeah. But the first few times I did it, the focus was on, and this is completely wrong, freaking out my mates and all of us going, oh, look how messed up we are. And the more I did it, the more it became, as we referenced in the previous ones, kind of a spiritual type thing in a way. I'm not a spiritual person, but in that kind of, right, let's see what parts of my brain I can activate and experience and see how that changes me as a person, essentially, like long term, and things I realise or open up to. So yeah.
I think what you're saying is really interesting here, because it seems quite different to all of the other substances that we've talked about so far, in that they tend to be more of a kind of social thing. Perhaps not tobacco, but certainly alcohol, certainly things like MDMA.
They're a night out drug.
Yeah, whereas psychedelics seem to be a much more kind of personal experience kind of a drug.
I totally agree. I got, and again, I only did them for a certain amount of time, but I got a lot more out of them personally. And again, this podcast isn't pro or anti, but I got more out of them when I realised exactly that, that it's not about seeing which of my mates that we can freak out the most or anything else. When I started to go, right, let's just enjoy the experience for what you can see. Because again, it's the things I'd read at the time, again, looking at Timothy O'Leary and people like that, the things I'd read at the time were about the fact that it changes the way you take in reality. And again, the whole theory there was what's to say which reality is any more or less real. And yeah, it was an interesting one.
Yeah, when we get onto the myths, one thing that someone told me is that DMT isn't actually a drug, and what it is a portal.
Right. So, brilliant.
That might be a little bit beyond the scope of this podcast to sort of get into. But
it is a fascinating one, as said, with the myths and beliefs and ideas, because for me, there was a lot of that, and I never had a bad trip as such. I've got close friends who did, and it really had a negative effect on them long term. So again, can't stress enough that this isn't pro or anti. It's coming from a lot of different experiences and research. But I had read that a bad trip is your subconscious panicking and trying to claw back to reality. Now, the stuff I'd read about the drug, I truly believe the theory that there's nothing to say that what you see on a hallucinogenic is any more or less real than what you see when you're not. It's just tweaking the way your eyes interpret light coming into your brain and so on and so forth. Yeah. So I believe the reason I didn't have a bad trip was because I was truly comfortable with that. So I didn't have that panic and clawing back.
Yeah, and I think this is something quite crucial in terms of the effects. If we move on to talking about the effects, that it's really quite unpredictable.
Yeah, hugely.
And it's hugely influenced by what is called set and setting. And so set is sort of what you as a person are bringing to the experience, sort of your mood or your history or all sorts of things about sort of you. And then setting is where you take it as well. So
completely.
It's the kind of drug that you might be tempted to, like, for the first time take at a festival or something like that, because people say, oh, it's amazing to walk through the trees or whatever.
Yeah.
But taking it in an incredibly crowded place where you've got very little control over sort of what externally is going to happen to you is a really, really bad idea, if you're not used to it, because the lack of control can be a terrifying thing when everything's not looking or doing what you expect
completely.
It to do.
And it's also an unpredictable one on the latency. Possibly one of the last times I took LSD, I took it with friends on a hilltop, and we were all like, this is going to be fun. We all took our half a tab or whatever. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened. We sat there for a while and we all went our separate ways. Now, on my walk to my then girlfriend's house, it kicked in and I had a lovely time. It was quiet street, so it wasn't intimidating. I took a long walk home. So the setting had changed, but I was having a good time. I then got to my girlfriend's house and just went to bed, and I had a horrible time because I was suddenly in the darkness with someone who wasn't on anything and was just like, just go to sleep. So I'm panicking. So in that one experience, I had those slight change of settings that you wouldn't predict that the outside one would be a better one than the inside in a safe place. But it's such an unpredictable experience.
Yeah, and because we're sort of talking about a few different substances here, they have different times to take effect.
Yeah.
So something like mushroom intoxication, if you drink it as a tea or chew it, then it can last up to 5 hours.
Yeah.
If you're given an intravenous psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in mushrooms, that sort of intoxication experience will only last around half an hour, probably.
Right.
And then LSD trips can last for sort of 7 to 8 hours. So they can be really, really long lasting things. And I think this can be part of the problem as well, is like the longer the trip lasts, the more chance there is that something bad will happen just because you're tripping for a longer time.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why people sometimes think that LSD, you're more prone to bad trips. And it's probably because the experience just lasts longer. So there's more time in which you can have a bad trip, if that makes sense.
The longer time you're on something that by its very nature is very unpredictable.
Yeah.
The more chance that something, and again, it's similar. It's why in many ways I don't do any drugs now is I feel the few times I did hallucinogenics, it went well. As we're saying there, the more times I roll that dice, the more chance it's going to not go well at all. So for me personally, it was kind of, I'm going to cash my chips in now. From what I know, it can last or can feel like it lasts for even longer than your 7-8
well,
hours.
I think this brings us on to what the intoxication effect of psychedelics actually is, which we sort of haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, sure.
Although it's probably quite apparent. So it's sort of perceptual alterations, I suppose, and also things like distortions of time and space as well. Mm-hmm. So rooms that you're in can look completely different to how they looked sort of before you take something, or you'll feel like you're running really fast or whatever, but you're actually moving very slowly. There's a story in David Nutt's book, Drugs Without the Hot Air, where he's talking about some teenagers that were driving and got pulled over, and they were on LSD. Driving on LSD is a terrible, terrible idea, by the way. But they got pulled over because they were going at 2 miles an hour, but they didn't realise because, I mean, you might think that's safer than driving on alcohol, but it's still a pretty terrible idea.
I mean, again, it's the weird one that there is a lot of drugs that people seem to think are okay to drive on, which, again, has always blown my mind because everyone seems to know that alcohol, because it's illegal to drive, and there was tons of mates of mine growing up who would never drink and drive, but would happily drive on pills or
cannabis
or anything else. It's like, right, well, they're still changing your
Certainly, well, cannabis massively slows your reaction times and all that kind of thing. So, but it's the sort of intoxication effects referred to as a trip, and sometimes it can be really enjoyable, and it sort of mimics the kind of hallucinations that might be associated with things like schizophrenia or psychosis, but for the most part doesn't bring along the sort of distress caused by them because you know it's going to happen because you've taken it.
Yeah.
If you are spiked with psychedelics, that can be extremely, extremely traumatic because it's very much a substance that you need to be aware of what's going to happen. Otherwise, it will be terrifying. You will think that you're going mad, probably.
Completely. I can't even imagine how horrendous that would be. And again, spiking is something that's always stunned me, that anyone sees that as a funny or
it's
enjoyable thing. But yeah, completely. The fact is, you can still panic and have a rough time when you know this is about to happen and you're choosing to do this. So yeah, if that just started happening outside of your own choice or awareness that it was going to happen, then that's
absolutely
horrendous.
And it's slightly different from things like the sort of hallucinations you get with schizophrenia as well, because psychedelics, for the most part, are sort of visual hallucinations, whereas with schizophrenia, it's much more common to have audio hallucinations, like hearing voices and that kind of thing. So although there are similarities, it's not sort of a model of drug model.
Yeah, that's interesting, because again, I'd say everything I can think of when looking back at using hallucinogenics, it's exactly that. It's all very visual. It's colours changing or textures or anything else changing visually. A wall can seem completely different. The wall we're in now with all the soundproofing on would blow my mind if you're wondering. But things like that, it never occurred to me that I'd never really had, even if you see some kind of creature or person or whatever else that wouldn't normally have been there, it never occurred to me I'd never really had any audio interaction with we have anything in that experience. So that's
And then depending on the substance that you're taking, if it's something that's sort of plant-based or that kind of thing, you can quite often, quite quickly after you take it, so with something like mushrooms, you might have stomach pains, feel a bit nauseous, potentially even sort of diarrhea.
Yeah.
But that's from the sort of poisonous mushroom aspect of what you're taking rather than the psychedelic. The psilocybin by itself doesn't give those symptoms. It's from the organic material that you're sort of consuming alongside it.
Yeah, you're taking poison. You're choosing to ingest poison for the positive effects, but there's going to be the negative. There's going to be some negative ones in there as well.
Okay, and if we think now about sort of slightly longer term results from taking psychedelics, some people report improvements in psychological well-being. And this is something that there was a loads of experiments done on LSD in the sort of in the 60s. They weren't necessarily brilliant research, but they sort of set the scene for kind of ideas that are being used again today. So although some people report improvements in psychological well-being, conversely in other people you might have sort of psychologically agitative kind of effects, so painful emotional material sort of coming to the surface during a trip.
Yeah.
And that's what I was saying about set and setting. So if the set...
Completely.
There's sort of the risk that these kind of things are there and a change in your mental state might bring them to the surface.
Yeah.
Then that can be pretty problematic for some people.
It's a weird one on how you gauge long-term effects, because things like ayahuasca, people don't generally say, oh, I'm going to do that every weekend. You do it once or maybe twice. It was originally used as kind of a coming-of-age thing, so at a certain age in your development, you'll take this to kind of open your mind to certain things. And for me, the long-term effects, I do feel, of the drugs I've done, hallucinogens have changed me or have had the most long-term effect, but not in a I still feel it in my blood type way, more in a, at the time, I experienced certain enlightenments. Sounds so hippie and ridiculous, but I was into all my 60s and 70s stuff at the time, but certain realisations and enlightenments that have affected how I am as a person and how I am as a human and how I interact and things like that. So of all the drugs, it's a hard one to nail down, because the long-term effects of alcohol are very much a calculable physical and mental thing, whereas the long-term effects of hallucinogens, it's like, well, it's so vague because it's such a psychological drug in itself. Mm-hmm. It's really...
So one of the weird things about psychedelics compared to almost all other recreational drugs is that it's not addictive.
Right.
So in fact, it's sort of almost anti-addictive in that if you take some immediately after you've just taken some, you will have absolutely no effect, because the kind of straight after you've had a trip, your tolerance is extremely high, so you just wouldn't be able to get another effect. So there's no drive when you take it to immediately take more. You
That's
don't really get, well, certainly no sort of physical or psychological kind of addiction qualities. There are people who do it very frequently, but to say that they're sort of addicted is a bit harder to say than for other drugs where there's a sort of mechanism by which this addiction
I mean, we've touched on previous ones and said that we might have to do a whole episode on addiction at some point. Is the fact is, all we can talk here really is of the physical addiction. Again, anyone can have a personality trait that can make them addicted to certain things. But as you said, with LSD, there's no medical addiction that can be recorded or documented
as
such.
And there's also no evidence of any long-term physical effects from taking LSD, which again is unlike most of these other substances that we've talked about, which can sort of have effects. If they raise your heart rate, for example, they can have long-term effects on your heart. If you metabolize them in your liver, they can have long-term effects on the liver, that kind of thing. There doesn't seem to be anything like this for psychedelics. But there are some risks. I mean, obviously, there are risks when you're intoxicated that you're not aware of the circumstances around you, and you're potentially more likely to sort of walk into roads or be unaware of your
circumstances.
I think
you can fly and all things like that. It's kind of the fear things put about at the time when I was growing up was all, oh, you'll think you can fly and you'll jump off a building or things like that. And as much as they're exaggerations, they're also, they're viable. It's one of those rare ones where a lot of the over-the-top anti-propaganda with most drugs, that comes into our myth section and you can cut that down. A thing like that, It's not going to happen a lot, but it's viable. It's a viable argument that you could feel some kind of,
Well, I think, I mean, there's no sort of documentation. In fact, I have got this down as a myth. LSD will make you think you can fly off, jump off a building, and then in brackets I've written, not necessarily entirely a myth.
Yeah, so it's exactly what you just said,
it's
really a fascinating one there,
That there are cases of people sort of falling off cliffs and things that where potentially they might have been intoxicated, but that could equally be from just being unaware of your surroundings rather than thinking I can fly and jumping. It's just sort of wandering aimlessly into a dangerous situation because you're sort of not as aware of what's going on around you.
The experience I had was I found, and again, I've been trying to think about these in advance of this so I can kind of be more succinct and articulate with it, but the experience I had with hallucinogens a lot of the time was most of the action was going on in my peripheral. As soon as I'd focus on it, a lot of the time it wouldn't be there, and that speaks a lot to what you were saying there, is you could easily not notice where you're going because you're so aware of stuff around you that you're not actually focused on the path in front of you as such, like quite literally the path in front of you in this instance.
And there are risks to certain people. Again, this comes down to the sort of set idea, that if you are an anxious person, for example, then losing control in the way that you do on psychedelics, sort of giving up your mind for a bit to these experiences that you can't control can be incredibly traumatizing and difficult. Yeah. And really, that probably means that these people will just never want to try it. It's not the kind of drug that would interest them, because that kind of experience just isn't desirable for people who have those kind of traits.
But again, as with all of these, there's always peer pressure or other things that could put someone who wouldn't naturally go towards this in that situation. And chances are it's not going to go well.
Yeah. And there are cases where using psychedelics can seem to trigger mental health problems through sort of unsupervised use of them. Mm-hmm. And again, these are probably in people who already have a higher susceptibility or risk for these kind of mental health problems. Potentially, they're already slightly have them underlying, and this kind of just brings it to the surface and triggers it.
Yeah,
and it's not very common, but it's still a risk, and it's something to bear in mind, certainly if you have a family history of psychiatric problems and that kind of thing, then it may well not be the drug of choice for you.
Yeah.
But then other people, and this is sort of goes back to what you've been saying, that it's quite a common reported that it can lead to sort of long-term or potentially permanent personality change, like an increased feeling of openness to others and to sort of the world more generally.
Yeah. It's a weird one, because before taking it, you'd read that this is the one drug that can mess you up forever. Mm-hmm. It can break your mind forever. And
just
it's that weird thing, it's like...
And
it's like, well, it can change your mind forever, but as we said, in not such a tangible way as you first interpret that when you're hearing it. When you read that, you presume it means it's going to do something that turns off a switch or turns on a switch and makes you permanently on edge or off kilter, but
Yeah, and I think it could trigger something severe that could be a problem for a very long time, but that's extremely, extremely rare.
Yeah.
And it's important to sort of get that kind of quantitative message across, that like there are risks, but in terms of comparison to risks from other substances, this is a pretty low risk substance,
and
if you're in a safe environment, and that's really key.
And that's the key in all these things, and partly the point of these podcasts is informing people of the risks and then allowing them to make an adult choice and decision. And I was thinking about this after the tobacco one, because that one blew me away a lot, because it was the one that we seemed... It was weird that tobacco and alcohol seemed to be the ones that had the most clear
really down
damage,
on,
but seemed to have the most negative effects. But it's that thing of, you can't just ban these things in such a manner, because equally, probably the most damaging thing to mankind on the whole is probably something like sugar, actually physical effects and things like that. Yet you've got to educate people on it and then give them that choice. And that's, you said, it's educating that there are risks, but this happens to be one that maybe is in the lower end of the risk, but it's still, a valid and legitimate risk.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting you mentioned sugar there, because a few people have messaged me asking for an episode on sugar, so potentially...
It'd be an interesting one, yeah.
Right, so should we move on to myths?
Yes.
Myths about psychedelics.
Well, just before we get there, I mean, I don't know if you even know this, but do you know kind of the history? Because a lot of the... synthetic drugs tend to, as we found out with MDMA and things like that, were used early on for counselling and are now coming around again to possibly being used in that situation. Do you know what the kind of the starting point was for hallucinogenics? Because again, I've heard it in relation to being developed as a drug to help schizophrenia, which makes sense now you've said that it's a similar area.
In terms of schizophrenia, when it was first discovered, it was more thought, this could be a model for schizophrenia that then we could use to work out treatments. So give LSD to healthy individuals to sort of induce kind of transient schizophrenia, if you like, and then work out how to treat.
But then, go on.
So LSD was, I'm not sure exactly when it was developed, actually, but the way that it was, this guy called Albert Hofmann, I think it was in the 60s, but it might have been a bit earlier than that. But he sort of realised what it was when he got some on his fingers and had a very unusual experience. And then the next day tried again, but took a proper amount, a very, very, very small amount, but deliberately took an amount. And it was... So had the first sort of trip.
Yeah.
And he then mentioned it to a lot of colleagues in psychiatry. Yeah. And a lot of them also then tried it, and then they started doing experiments with it in psychiatric hospitals.
Yeah.
And then Timothy Leary, who was also at university, took it further and wanted to do a lot of research. And originally he was very supported and got lots of funding to do it.
Yeah.
But then his experiments were going way beyond sort of what he had ethical approval or, or I don't know if they had ethics councils in unis in the 60s, but certainly what the university thought that he was doing. And then he got sacked.
Yeah.
But he carried it on in his house,
yeah.
Carried on doing the experiments that he was doing. But he sort of brought it so much to the public domain that lots of people started using it recreationally, and that's when it sort of came apparent to lawmakers.
Yeah.
And they decided that no, this should be a class A. Well, I think this was in the States, so they don't quite have the same class systems, but the equivalent of a class A drug with no medical benefits, which meant all of the research that had previously been going on, although Timothy Leary was really keen on this research and was taking part in it, in a way him bringing it to the public attention sort of made that all slightly more difficult, because it also brought it to the attention of sort of lawmakers.
Yeah, I remember reading a quote from him later in his life saying his biggest regret was bringing the drug to the public eye, but not the culture of it or the that's a synthetic types, but the more natural types it is. It's a traditional thing of a shamanic experience of it being a coming of age thing of it being so. He said later on in his life that he regretted hugely, kind of saying, look, here's this drug. And people went, let's take loads of this and do it all the time. And it's like, that's not the culture of it that he then learnt that it should have had.
Well, yeah, so the history of the sort of more, the naturally occurring plant-based psychedelics is probably the most sort of far back in human history these drugs were being used.
Yeah.
They've probably been used for millennia. That's not even an exaggeration.
Yeah.
In those kind of, coming-of-age ritualistic shamanic settings.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's get on to the myths.
I
took us off track briefly.
No, it's good. So we've sort of talked a bit about the idea of making you think you can fly and jump off a building. It's potentially an aspect of the trip, but could also just be you're much more likely to injure yourself if you're unaware of your surroundings and you're wandering about. So again, setting is important.
And similar to pretty much every drug that we could talk about, really, in that instance, I'd say you could probably just as easily jump off a building drunk.
Well, yeah, absolutely.
As you possibly could on hallucinogens.
And I wonder if it's because people enjoy tripping outside in nature, surrounded by nature, that maybe they're more likely to be at risk of wandering off a cliff or something like that.
Yeah.
Or they're up on the roof because they want to look at the sky. So perhaps it's the nature of psychedelia that means it's more sort of appealing to be in dangerous situations when you take it. But bad idea. Okay, the next one I've got written down is psychedelics cause schizophrenia or mental health problems. And we've sort of touched on this already, that there are anecdotal reports of this, but it's one of those things, again, where it's really, really hard to rigorously research this, because when you get someone turning up at a hospital who's quite clearly unwell with a psychotic disorder, working out why it happened is slightly less important than helping that person in the moment right now. And so you can't really to look at it in a big population studies as well, because psychotic disorder is quite rare. It's the same with cannabis, that actually working out whether these things are really causal, and if so, who in particular is vulnerable, is really difficult. But again, it's the sort of common sense almost that if you have a load of other risk factors for psychotic disorder, like a family history or like traumatic childhood and early life adversity and that kind of thing, then all of these things just increase your risk incrementally of a psychotic disorder. So psychedelic substances that cause mind-altering effects are going to be another risk factor to that. But they're definitely not necessary or sufficient. Again, it's not the case that if you take it, you will definitely get a psychotic disorder. Absolutely not.
It's one of them where, as we've touched upon before, you can... exactly as you said, causation versus correlation of that is it simply that someone in these situations is more likely to be taking this drug or doing this, and therefore it looks linked, or it looks like, it's an impossible one to gauge in that manner. And again, like with all of these, it's not to keep going on about a legality, because that's obviously the focus of the Stop and Search podcast, also on the Distraction Pieces Network. I got a quick plug in there. but it's with all of these drugs being illegal, it's so much harder to have any real valid research and prolonged research because of the restrictions upon it all, right? Or at least the perception of it all.
Yeah, it's certainly more difficult to recruit participants. Yeah. It's more difficult to... Well, I mean, I've not tried, but certainly people like David Nutt who do this kind of research say it's more difficult to get the funding to actually do it and be able to run these studies.
Yeah.
But that's coming on to that after the myths. Sure. There is some research going on at the moment that's very interesting.
Great.
But so the next myth I have is that drinking juice, in particular orange juice, will reduce a bad trip. But some people also say that it will like augment the trip and make it last longer or shorter.
So. Yeah, I've heard loads of different things. I've heard them recently, actually, where in America, edibles have become more popular. So edible cannabis and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they apparently, a lot of them have some kind of hallucinogenic or psychedelic of effects. And again, hearing that if you eat these ones and drink this particular brand of watermelon juice or something like that, and it's crazy. It's like, this feels like just really good marketing to try and sell this with that. But I remember hearing in my youth, Sunny Delight was pushed hugely as get some of that in while you've got your hallucinogens as a company.
So there's no evidence that orange juice makes any difference to your trip, but I was just wondering whether it might come from so grapefruit juice can interact with a lot of medication, so things like immunosuppressant medication and that kind of thing, and lots of people who are on certain medications are told to avoid grapefruit juice.
Right.
So that's, I wonder whether it's just sort of a misunderstanding of why that is, and getting the wrong citrus fruit or something like that. But
that's fascinating.
Okay, the next one I have. DMT is produced by the brain at birth and at death.
Right.
So there's no evidence that this is the case, but again, this is something that's pretty hard to research.
Yeah.
But I think with around psychedelics, there's so much sort of mythologizing around the substances.
It's so classic
because of
as
the
well.
Way, because of the effect that they have.
Yeah,
I think.
It's so classic as well. Because again, I always remember hearing like, this is how our brains used to work when we were cavemen and stuff like that, and all these different things of it's just to make out that it's a completely natural thing when it's not. It's altering. You're taking something to alter your...
Yeah. I wonder if Gaspar Noé is slightly responsible for this as well. The film Enter the Void is sort of around that kind of topic.
Completely, completely.
It's pretty extreme film.
It's one of my favourite films. I love Gaspar Noé. I think Irreversible and Enter the Void are both just... Enter the Void, weirdly, is actually a great example here because the way he shot it, a lot of the visuals, it is reminiscent of being on hallucinogens. And particularly, I remember I saw both Irreversible and Enter the Void in small cinemas.
Yes.
So because there will be certain... But like, it's the closest I've come to thinking I was going to have a panic attack. Because
or vomit, I felt. Yeah, sick.
The flashing of lights. And when you're in a small room and it takes over the whole room, it's genuinely... Purely the visuals, I've not even taken anything, but purely the visuals are having that physical effect on your body.
Well, I think that's what he sort of goes for, is to try and sort of elicit that kind of feeling to people who've not taken anything. Like, just if you would go
onto YouTube...
Probably
isn't going to work if you're watching it on your phone.
The opening credits are just of Enter the Void are incredible.
Yeah, definitely.
Anyway, that was a big detour, sorry. So, flashbacks.
Yes.
Now, lots of people... This was a big sort of warning that loads of people have said to me. It's like, I've never tried psychedelics because I've been told that
flashbacks,
just any time when I'm just driving my children to school or walking down the street, I can have a flashback that'll be just as vivid as the original trip and there's nothing I can do about it, and that's terrifying. So, but people have been trying to sort of look at this, and via sort of questionnaire studies and that kind of thing, there's very little evidence for flashbacks. There is more evidence of sort of slight perceptual abnormalities that happen for maybe a few weeks or so after a trip, and typically subside quite soon after that.
Yeah.
And the people who've reported these in these kind of questionnaires generally say that they like them, that it's not unpleasant. But I think that is something that can put people off doing psychedelics, is the idea that at any time you might get these flashbacks.
It's definitely a fascinating one, and it's just reminded me now as we're doing this one that the most tweets I've had is about how much of what you tell me I say is fascinating.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating. But it's a fascinating one because again, it's a cause. It's finding a causation thing, because I've had moments where I've looked at something and it's gone a bit weird, and I've wondered, is that because of doing LSD in the past? But equally, you'll get them things on Facebook now or in newspapers that say, stare at this for 30 seconds and then look over there and the wall kind of looks like it's melting.
Yeah.
And it's these things where your mind, certain things will make your mind and eyes do weird stuff.
Yeah.
Now, it's easy to have one of them happen naturally. Again, we're in a room that's got a lot of vertical and horizontal lines, a lot of pattern,
yeah,
which if we stared at that for long enough and then looked somewhere else, it'd probably look weird.
Yeah, you'd get after images.
It'd freak your eyes out and get after images. Now, it's easy if you've done hallucinogens in the past to then say, oh, that's because of my history of drugs.
Exactly.
But it's like, well,
sort
no, that probably would have happened
bias,
anyway.
Recall bias, basically, yeah.
Completely.
If you've done it, you're more likely to attribute it to that.
Exactly that. I've had points in the months or whatever after I'd done acid or whatever else where I felt I'd had flashbacks. Mm-hmm. But now I can say, well, again, I can remember one clearly. I was looking at one of them, a metal grids that have kind of got a grip diamond pattern on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was at work and I'd been looking at that for a bit, and then I looked around and it all kind of spun me out. The fact is, I'm staring at a pattern. There's bright a light hitting onto it.
Yeah.
It's probably nothing to do with the drugs I've done at some point in my life.
Yeah, and now again, this is one of those cases where lack of evidence isn't evidence of the things not existing.
Sure,
so
sure.
It is possible that some people could get flashbacks. And there is a disorder that is very rare but does happen where you do get persistent perceptual abnormalities
right
after taking psychedelics. But again, this is an extremely rare disorder. It's
yeah
rarer than schizophrenia and that sort of thing.
Right.
So these kind of things are small risks, but potentially, again...
Yep.
And just because we haven't found evidence of them doesn't mean that they aren't there. And some people do report, like, well, things like what you're saying as well. But that's not the case of suddenly feeling like you're absolutely back in the vividness of the original experience. It's like a sort of aftershock or after image, I guess.
Completely. And again, all you can give there is the loose research and facts that's been found. It's impossible. And I can speak from my experience, but my experience will be completely different to someone else's experience. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why this is quite a hard one to talk about the scientific evidence for, because although there's lots of it, it is such a sort of personal experience that it's much harder to sort of definitively say, well, these are the risks and these aren't, because I think, it's so I hope this doesn't feel like a cop-out, sorry, guys. But again, it's one of those things.
I mean, you nailed it at the start, and the thing that I think everything we've talked about all comes back to set and setting is the fact that those two things can completely vary. The myths, the actual experience at the time, the physical effects, all of that, that all seems to come back to that.
All right, next myth. LSD, or psychedelics, can open up parts of the brain that aren't usually used.
Yeah.
So I just rolled my eyes. This is my sort of least favourite kind of bugbear about the brain, that we only use 10% of our brains and the rest of it can be unlocked via brain training or psychedelics or whatever. It's just, I think this myth might come about because the brain is made up of neurons, right?
Yeah.
Which are sort of long, thin cells that send electrical impulses to other neurons in the brain, and that's how messages are kind of delivered. Between the neurons, there are these gaps called synapses, and the neurotransmitters, which are generally the things that are altered by recreational drugs, like the levels of them or how much they're picked up, they transfer the impulse across the gaps between neurons, and that's how the brain passes messages around it.
Right.
In a nutshell, that was a very, very
good. I liked
quick
it.
Summary of how the brain works. Cut off quite a few corners, but then you've got the gist. But these neurons are really, really long, right? And if you know much about if electricians who are listening or people who know much about electrical conductivity will know that to transfer an electrical impulse down a long, thin cable, you get a lot of sort of resistance and leakage. So there around the neurons, there are sort of lumps of fat, basically, these things, what are they called? Myelin sheaths. And if you covered the whole thing in like insulation, it would still take a long time. But what they do is, how the brain's developed is that you get sort of bits of myelin and then gaps. And that means that the electrical impulse sort of leaps down from gap to gap.
Right.
And so the brain can, this is again really, really simplistic. So there's neuroscientists listening to this with their heads in their hands. I'm really sorry, but it's sort of trying to get the idea across. But anyway, the point is the brain is full of all this kind of fatty lumps, basically, that aren't neurons or aren't synapses or neurotransmitters, and they're just there to help the brain fire more quickly, but we don't use them for thinking. So I wonder if that's where this myth that we'd only use 10% of our brain comes from.
Right, yeah. So it's the bits that are, that is jumping across, essentially.
Yeah, but like...
But again,
taking psychedelics isn't going to help, because those bits of the brain, they serve a purpose. Just because they're not there for thinking doesn't mean they're not useful.
It's a myth that I'd completely heard, as I touched upon, that it uses parts of your brain that we used to use when we were cavemen. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe that's why we saw dinosaurs and stuff. And just genuinely, I've had them conversations as a teen going, mate, you know, you say how crazy things were, all these cave drawings. Mm. It's because we were using different parts of our brain.
Or the lizard brain.
All this. It's like, nah. That's kind of ridiculous.
But
I totally believed it, though. I was totally on board. I was like, yeah, man.
We all believe lots of things as a teenager. But having said that, though, it does seem to change the way that neurons talk to each other. So there's been some really cool work done in Imperial in London, where they've put people on LSD in brain scanners and looked at the connectivity between neurons. And so the way the brain sort of typically works is you've got these little circuits that talk to each other in the brain. Mm-hmm. And it seems like what LSD does from these studies, and they weren't on very many people, so they're very much sort of early days of these kind of studies, but it seems to make these individual little networks fire less. But then globally, the brain seems to be sort of firing or sending out impulses more. So less sort of individual level communication, more global communication is kind of the theory behind
it. It's interesting.
So perhaps that's sort of not opening up parts of the brain that aren't normally used, but opening up connections that aren't normally used.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something in it. I apologise for rolling my eyes. LSD is stored in body fat, so can be released at any time. And I think this is sort of related to flashbacks.
Right.
But yeah, there's not really any evidence for this at all.
No.
And this was another, I think, evolutionary myth as well, that it was really useful because you would have this LSD in your fat stores. So if you were ever in a situation where you were like lost in the jungle with no food or anything, and then the LSD would kick in after you lost a certain amount of weight, and it would help in some way.
Right.
Not LSD, obviously, but the organic psychedelic. Yeah.
That's a bizarre one, yeah.
Yeah. And then the last one I've got is one we've sort of already touched on, though. You're less likely to have a bad trip on mushrooms versus LSD because they're natural.
Right.
But this is not at all because they're natural, but it's because of what I said earlier, that you just have a slightly shorter trip on mushrooms than LSD, so there's just less time to have a bad trip.
But then equally, you're more likely to feel ill physical effects, as you said, because of the poison or whatever else is potentially in these mushrooms. Mm. But yeah, that's an interesting one. It's, again, I had always had it seen as mushrooms are a softer, smoother trip, and LSD or microdots or whatever else are then ramping it up. But yeah, I guess it's just it's longevity. It's it's the length of time you're on it.
Yeah.
So that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Also, this whole natural versus synthetic thing is another one of my little bugbears, so I'm rolling my eyes again.
The idea
that something is natural, so therefore it's better. But we've touched on that on lots of the other episodes, so there's no need to go through that again. Okay, so are there any benefits of psychedelics?
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of work going on at the moment looking at psychedelics. So I should say that when I was doing the notes for this, I sent them to Robin Carhart-Harris, who works at Imperial and who was involved, or I think was the lead author in the paper that I just mentioned about the brain scanning paper.
Yeah.
And he's also doing work looking at using psilocybin for treatment-resistant depression.
Right.
And this is a similar kind of way to the way we were talking about the use of MDMA and the use of ketamine, that you would have a small dose to sort of try and in a therapeutic setting.
Yeah.
And as a kind of, I don't want to use the word reset, but just a kind of helping someone to get out of the negative sort of thought processes that they're in and kind of start to see the world in a different way. As we've talked about, that's sort of the effects that people report when taking psychedelics. So,
but again, as similar to in the MDMA episode and the ketamine episode, it's the suggestion there is using them in isolated instances rather than it being, oh, here's your prescription
of
mushrooms. Yeah. You know, can they take these once a week? It's in this situation, again, as you said, as a reset's a bad word for it, but as some kind of right here, we're going to try and have that, get the benefit from it in this one situation, and then hopefully that will
just set you on a different path. Yeah. But when I sent my notes to Robin and he came back with some great comments, he also told me that there's loads of other research going on as well. So people are looking at using it as a treatment for obsessive compulsive disorder, for death anxiety, for people who have a terminal illness, and sort of helping them to sort of come to terms with that.
Right, and, that's fascinating.
Yeah. But also for loads of addictions as well. So it's potentially being used for tobacco addiction and alcohol dependence.
Yeah.
And in fact, certainly alcohol dependence, those kind of studies were initially done in the 60s before that, the kind of research into LSD stopped.
Yeah.
And there's also ideas about how it can be used to help improve well-being and to reduce psychological distress and suicidality. So although at the moment we don't know too much about these kind of positive effects, there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of thought within scientific communities and medical communities that it could be really, really helpful for a number of different sort of psychological problems.
Yeah, yeah. It's great, and it's fascinating that we're at that time with things, that the openness is there, because a while back it would seem ridiculous that you'd be even putting forth the suggestion that you'd use one of the scary illegal drugs to help with addiction to one of the nice, friendly, legal drugs, tobacco or alcohol. Again, the fear is that the more common drugs are a gateway to the heavier drugs, and this is kind of going, well, no, this can be used to help you get off them ones that are doing maybe more physical damage and so on and so forth. It's great.
And there we are. Once again, thank you for listening. Now, I'm actually going to ask a bit of a favour now. I'd love it if people listening could all do me a favour. So the good people at Acast, who host this podcast, are conducting a survey of their listeners, and it would be great if you could fill it out so that I can find out a little bit more about the people who listen to this podcast. So if you just go to survey.acast.com, and it'll take less than 5 minutes. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next episode in 2 weeks' time, where Pip and I will be saying why to cocaine. You've been listening to Say Why to Drugs with me, Dr. Susie Gage. The music and editing were by Jim Murray. The artwork is by @MyNameIsAd. Say Why to Drugs would not have been possible without the generous support of I'm a Scientist, Get Me Out of Here, the Medical Research Council, and Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces Network.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.